"What is real?" asked the Velveteen Rabbit. But the Skin Horse didn't reply. He just sat there trying to watch the game. The rabbit asked way too many stupid questions. I'm Ansi McLean, and this is Resisting Enlightenment. This is the podcast that unwisely revisits our most embarrassing, awkward moments and offers nothing but impotent commiseration. Oh, I'm with Spoons. Spoons, how you doing, man?
Man, I'm good. I'm great. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Chris,
we haven't seen each other in a while.
I know. It's been a while. You've been working very hard and traveling and doing shows with another just a great band here in Nashville. You play with the Natchez Tracers.
Yes, sir.
And you've been playing with those guys, and they're awesome.
We have a good time, man. we had a gig Friday night. Man, Nashville's hard to play in sometimes. It's hard to play original music in Nashville sometimes.
Yeah.
And have people come out. Unless you're pretty happening. You know?
Yeah, and you were in East Nashville, right? Is that where you played Friday?
Yeah, around that area. Yep.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great places to play and a lot of great places to see live original music, you know. But yeah, you just gotta support it. You know, not just go see the cover bands.
Well, that's true. You know, you can go down to Lower Broadway and do the touristy thing and support that. And that's good. I mean, there are a lot of musicians down there, great musicians. Mm. But these guys that play around Middle Tennessee, just on the parameters of Nashville, you know, there's some amazing talent. And if you're coming through Nashville as a tourist, I usually tell folks to go see a writer's night or a local venue that's playing some local artists. And that happens a lot in East Nashville around here.
Yeah.
But there's also Franklin has some places, and you know, Hendersonville has some places. And there's anyway, there's a great variety. And but it's hard, right? It's, it's like you feel like one out of 3 million birds chasing about 35 worms, you know. Don't you feel that way sometimes being a musician in Nashville?
Yeah. I'm trying to do the math. I can't.
Oh, man, there's math. Oh, damn it. Yeah, musicians, man, we don't do math. Okay. Gotcha. Let me simplify the analogy. Do you ever feel that you're one NASCAR driver in a field of other, like hundreds of other NASCAR drivers fighting for a lane?
You nailed it. That's perfect. Yes. Well, I just had this discussion with somebody.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Man, nice. Don't you just feel like you're one NASCAR driver in a bunch of other NASCAR drivers?
Just turning right. Like forever.
Constantly
just turning right. It might be left. No, it's right. I think it's right.
It's right. I think they go to
the left. No, it's a left. It's a left-hand turn.
Man, those are tough.
I don't know my NASCAR. Need to brush up on my NASCAR. And I'm, you know, Larry the Cable Guy would be ashamed of me, I think, right now.
But yeah, for sure. You know, if you can get to the outskirts of Nashville and stay away from the touristy. Well, I mean,
spend one day down there. Go down there. Go to Lower Broadway for a day.
Yes,
experience all of that.
The talent level of the guys that are downtown playing, and their wealth of knowledge and of the tunes and being able to call these tunes up and you know, chart all of these tunes. There's some incredible talent downtown.
Oh, absolutely, man.
It's amazing. But also get to the outskirts and get to some of these places that are playing local live music.
Yeah, I agree.
Because there's some amazing stuff there as well.
Yeah. I mean, we do these field trips like three times a year is about all that I have the time and the energy for, and certainly Dina Lynn has the energy for. I mean, it's a lot of work on her part to put these things together. But, you know, we have up to 20 people that come and experience Nashville in a very intimate way. It's like we're not just doing the tourist thing. But I do encourage them to come like a day early, go down to Lower Broadway. I don't want to go down there with you, but you know, just go down there and check it out. But yeah. I will drive them down, and we roll the windows down, and we get to hear it. So there's like, you know, 20 of us in a van, and we're driving down Lower Broadway, listening to the cacophony of sound.
Yeah.
It's like from left and right and above and below, and it's like...
It's a spectacle.
Do you think there's anywhere on earth that has more live music being played by individuals in a limited square footage?
Yeah.
I mean, it's four blocks, maybe five blocks, both sides of the street, crammed full of music. It's like, I don't know that little bit of a territory has more live music going on anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
They ought to really promote that.
Yeah, they ought to name, like, the city needs to be, well, like Music City, right?
It should be called Music City. Wow, wait. You're on to something. All right, I'm calling the mayor. You know, you guys ought to call yourselves Music City. We already do that. Oh, really? Okay. Thank you for your time. Have a nice rest of your day. Resisting Enlightenment is brought to you by Big Rafe's Meat and Five. There are plenty of comfort food restaurants in Pineview Heights, right here on the outskirts of Nashville, but Big Rafe's is discomfort food. Not very good, but they give you plenty of it. Now, if you like chicken and waffles, and who doesn't, huh? You gotta try Big Rafe's meatloaf and pancakes, a huge three-stack sampling of flapjacks fresh from Big Rafe's griddle, topped with yesterday's leftover meatloaf and slathered up with his secret ketchup-based glaze. Big Rafe's Meat and Five, a discomfort food restaurant, and they're ready to serve you. We're also supported by Stubby's Discount Fireworks. This week, come out and save on two of Stubby's most popular lines, Shotgun Wedding and Grounds for Divorce. These are finale packages voted loudest and best by Fireworks is Awesome, a blog operated somewhere in the Midwest by a 40-year-old dude in his mother's basement. Shotgun Wedding and Grounds for Divorce finale packages would make the perfect gift, don't you think? For that couple starting off, or that couple heading to court. What better way, in either one of those situations, to blow off some steam than to don that sleeveless t-shirt, put that PBR 12-pack on ice, and light some shit up in the backyard? Stubby's Discount Fireworks. There's something there for everyone. So what are you afraid of? Spoons? Chris Spoons Long? What are your fears? What are you most afraid of?
What am I most afraid of? For me, that almost changes from year to year.
Yeah.
You know, I used to have a real typical, you know, fear of failing, you know, that kind of thing. But it's certainly something, as you get older and wiser, you realize that failing is probably one of the best things you could possibly do.
But, because of what you learned?
Yeah, yeah. But one of the best things that can happen to you is failure, you know.
Hmm. Yeah, so one of the best things that can happen to you then isn't finding a reasonably priced ice cream truck rolling through your neighborhood.
Yeah.
It's actually failing.
Right.
I don't know if I'm buying it, man. I think it's finding a reasonably priced ice cream truck rolling through your neighborhood.
You gotta find bomb
if
pops.
There was a close second. Okay, a close second would probably for me be failing.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Life is hard, man. This is and it doesn't get easier.
No.
You know, I was thinking it was easy. It's easier when you're a kid. Life is blissful. For most kids, now there are those who go through hell and pain is inflicted upon them by grown-ups and all that sort of thing. That's not what I'm talking about. But just being the quote-unquote regular kid and the kid's life in America in the 20th century, you know, I mean, we're 21st century now we are in. And it's like, wow, so there's a certain level of comfort we can expect. And then we get to a point where life just starts getting harder every year. It's like, oh, damn, there's more responsibility and more, you know.
Well, is it that it gets harder, or have we lost our kid-like, you know, sensibilities? Because I know, you know, kids, I mean, they will take a chance on anything because they don't know that it's hard.
They don't know
that it's going to hurt. It's going to be difficult. They don't know that they're going to fall flat on their face, you know, if they take
two steps.
Well, and then
to that extent, I mean, there are kids that I grew up with, you did too, who they knew the extent of the pain but didn't care.
Yeah.
And were fearless in that. And they just like, well, pain's not a big deal. I'm going to scrape my knee maybe if I fall. So we had this kid, Dickie Kincaid, and I'm friends with him on Facebook. Dickie, if you're out there, hey, man. And he and Ella are wonderful, living a happy life, and they've got kids and grandkids and everything's cool. But once upon a time, he was this little fearless daredevil in our neighborhood.
Yeah.
And he could get on a bike, one of which we all had, just something out of something from Walmart or Kmart or whatever. And we would set up any number of ramps for him. The ultimate, finally, at the end of the day, being the picnic table that my father had made and had in the side yard. And we just, all eight or nine of us, would pick it up and move it out to the road. And then we'd put my sliding board. We took wrench and disconnected my sliding board and the swing set. It's actually my sister Tiffany's sliding board. I removed it, but I put it back. But anyway, so and taking it apart and then ramping that up with like bricks, cinder blocks underneath it, so it formed a ramp up over the picnic table. And so he was the neighborhood's Evel Knievel, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome.
and we were just like, I wouldn't do it. Randy Kincaid wouldn't do it. Joey Thompson, his half-brother, wouldn't do it. Not, you know, there's nobody willing to do this. And Dickie's like 6-7 years old, man. Doesn't give a shit.
Yeah, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Set that shit up. Yeah. Let's go.
So he winds way back and everything, and he tests, you know, the sliding board, making sure it's sturdy and, you know, bike worthy, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes way back and he
does he test the air? Does he lick a finger and stick it in the air?
Yeah, he probably did. I don't know. Yeah. No, he was like this stoic little 6-7-year-old. He winds up, man. He jumps over that sucker, lands beautifully.
Yeah,
I still see it in my mind in this slow motion, kind of like episode from Here Comes Bronson or something from the early 70s, a show that I worshipped. And then he just lands and skids into a stop. And it was beautiful, man. We were like, I don't remember applauding because we were all kind of annoyed at him at the same time. That little shit.
Yeah. It's like he nailed it.
Yeah, it was like
totally.
We were all secretly hoping he'd wipe out gravel embedded in his skin as he scraped across the, you know.
Nailed it, and, yeah, bastard.
Man, he was great. Yeah, and I just always loved that kid, man. He was you know, fearless and you know, taught us about fear. Well, I'm so glad you asked. I actually, oddly enough, I've been writing about fear. I've been writing some songs about it, just working some stuff out in my head, stuff that keeps me up at night. And some of it can get kind of dark, but a lot of it's just silly, you know? It's once I kind of start picking it apart, I see just how ridiculous I'm being. So, and maybe this is one of them, I don't know, but... you know, this is a piece on my fear of being thought of as a fraud in any way. And so I'll share that with you now. There it is, that voice again, the one telling me I'm a fraud. I'm cleaning the kitchen, man, I yell back in my head. What about myself right now is a fraud? I'm just loading the damn dishwasher. This house is fake, it answers back. Your relationships are fake. Your clothes are fake. Your hair, fake. Face, fake. Who you are is a facade. Well, I get to laughing at this because I pay the mortgage every month, and this house is very much real. Just ask the bank, who very much owns it. I just brought my wife coffee, and she kissed me, and we say we love each other and mean it many times a day. I'm on good terms with my kids. I have wonderful friends. These clothes, while cheap, every stitch probably made in China and shipped to me in an Amazon box, well, it's all quite real. My hair is very real, uncolored and graying in streaks at my temples. And my face, well, it's real, untucked, unstretched. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, the voice might have me there. I will Photoshop spots on my face or give my double chin a little tuck here and there in posters and album covers. I mean, I've been my own graphic artist to save me money for my entire career. And these are courtesies I go about quietly for my own freelance graphic clients, so surely I can afford myself the same courtesy. Is it the Photoshopping? I ask the voice. Because, yeah, I'll use the rubber stamping tool here and there, but nothing extensive. That's still me on that poster. No answer. Dude, I say to the voice, I'm an Americana artist, okay? No one's going to buy some airbrushed, overpolished thing from me. Still no answer. Your work is fake, says the voice finally. Your music is fake, your art is fake, therefore no part of you is authentic. You're a cheap, skin-deep knockoff, an imitation of everything you've ever heard or absorbed. And there it is. My deepest fear, ringing in my ears from an ancient bell tower and reverberating in my chest like sick, green ocean waves. This fear is what keeps me awake at night sometimes, holds me hostage until bourbon and noise and whatever else will quiet it. My identity, the very meaning of who I am, is attached to my work, bound by a dark, wet, sticky root system, until every facet of who I am, son, brother, father, husband, friend, is affected by the attack on my work. Chip away at the core of me, and all of me will weaken and fall. Just a bit. Now, I remember warning men of this in classes I once taught long ago in another life as a kind of a shepherd of sorts, we'll say. Years of listening and observing gave me a layman's knowledge of living by trial and error, heavy on the error, of course, or at least what could be learned from it. I can remember voicing these words to these guys in a class situation. Do not let your work define who you are, because one day your work, your vocation will change, and you will be lost. You will be lost. These are horrible words to someone in their 30s, early 40s, working on a career, climbing ladders, getting to a place, fulfilling their goals. To be lost is a terrible thing. Then add the complexity of being an artist, living as a creative person, making your way by your wits and whatever talent you might have, and it gets more complicated. Isn't art more than a vocation? Doesn't it define us, those of us it touches? Who touch it back, who embrace it and can't let it go? I mean, unlike a vocation, I will never retire from being an artist. My creative friends and I have often said, we'll likely die in the middle of writing a song, painting a landscape, singing, driving to a gig, cooking a great meal, whatever it is that defines us. Because it's not just a vocation to us, it's a way of life. It's how we live. Now, if we are to create in the act of living, which is what I've been taught, and it's kind of the core to my own philosophy as an artist, create in the act of living, then it's logical to assume we will also be creating in the act of, well, dying. And I am sure my last thoughts will be amazement at the feelings, the sensations, the virtual kaleidoscope of what's going on in my brain as I take my last breaths. In death, as in life, I won't want to miss a thing. But there's still the subject of this annoying voice, deep and still and ringing from that ancient bell tower by some 100-year-old hunched, darkened figure who clearly does not have my best interests at heart. Or does he? Is he really 100 years old? Is he really that distant? Or is he a little closer to me than I might want to realize? His voice sounds an awful lot like my own sometimes. Well, it's been said that artists are made up of one part absolute narcissism and the other part crippling insecurity. Guilty as charged. I guess I've known enough of that personality type that I can't say I would disagree with the description, however stung I might be by the association. We are self-absorbed as artists. I mean, we kind of have to be. It takes a lot of time and a lot of work, and we don't just come into this world able to write a song or a story or a book or a painting isn't just made by us desiring to want to paint. It takes work and craft to get to that point. And some of us get tripped up by the mere mechanics, and we become workaholics, and we put that cart before the horse and miss out on a lot of stuff in life. Well, we are self-absorbed. Okay. I can admit to that. And we're certainly insecure. Now, in a world so vast, it's easy to feel like the speck I am, watching all the greatness being done around me, going to a concert, reading a book, seeing a movie, and being so stunned by the greatness that we are at once inspired to create ourselves and reduced to thoughts of giving up. Going to a great concert may inspire me to want to write a song, but it also may inspire me to just slide my guitar under the bed forever and take that job at the tire store and just give up. Well, this is ridiculous. We know this. We know it's ridiculous to want to give up after seeing someone who is great and accomplished. But that's that voice inside of us telling us we're a fraud. All but a small fraction of artists, the vast majority of us, toil our lives away only to be forgotten by all but a handful of people who call us friend, lover, family. And I reckon I'll be dealing with this voice for a while yet to come. It's not like you can just throw a roommate out, never have to deal with them again. It's going to take years, especially if they've been hanging around for a long time. There's the matter of unpaid rent and utility bills, mutual friends, and they have that shelf in the fridge with their stuff on it, stuff you'd never eat, but you know it's just going to go to waste and you got to deal with it somehow. Now, once you get a little distance from them, you realize that'll be just fine. But now, in the stinging damp of night, when things are quiet enough you hear every anemic heartbeat, you're not so sure. But inside yourself, you know. You just have to be lost for a little while. It'll be okay. Because maybe being lost is just what you need right now. You can always be found later.
It's a funny thing being afraid of myself, scared of going deeper down my own well. What will I find down there? Why would I even care about it anyway? There's a voice I hear down in my soul, crawling up like a worm from a deep dark hole. It tells me I'm not enough, that I'm unworthy of the love you gave. And if I listen close, I'll find the voice sounds an awful lot like mine, I hate to say. And I might see the light of day if I could get out of my own way. Well, we try to blame others for where we've been, but I've always held the keys to the cages I'm in. Whether or not I'm free, it's always been up to me. Is it cloudy or gray? And I might see the light of day if I could get out of my own way. And I might see the light of day if I could get out of my own way.
The other night, Dina Lynn and I watched a peculiar collection of videos on YouTube. It was a 30-minute compilation of failed TV sitcom openings from the 1980s. The intros to shows we've never heard of, with actors, save a few, who've all but evaporated from the spotlight of show business. It was funny because it all looked so dated and out of touch, you know, and the thing of the day was sort of like when, on these openings, at least what it looked like to me was like the actors had to, when they were introduced in the opening of the show, they had to act like they were being caught off guard, and they would turn around and look at you like, what, you guys? And then they would do this gesture of like, oh, get out of here. You know, it was just that sort of thing. And every actor did the same thing. You're like, what, you guys? Hey, oh, get out of here. And then their name would appear at the bottom, you know. And the theme song, every one of these theme songs just seemed like somebody had heard all of Mike Post's work from the late 70s, you know, the Rockford Files and all that stuff, and then just sort of like copied it on a Casio keyboard. You know, it was that kind of thing. Anyway, it was kind of cool though, because, you know, where else are you going to see this kind of stuff? You know, it's just kind of, it's lost in the annals of time, and now we can, you know, go into YouTube and find this stuff. You know, someone has kept it and puts it up there. I think it's great. So it sent Dina and me off on a scavenger hunt of sorts. You know, these, as sad as it was, this particular kind of time capsule containing not our memories, but someone's hope of our memories that just didn't pan out, you know. And so we learned a lot about these folks on Wikipedia, you know, like what their other projects were, family info, and, you know, where they were born, all that stuff. It was really interesting. We spent probably 2.5 hours on just Wikipedia looking up these actors. You know, we jot their names down and go, you know, we like weird stuff, and we don't make any excuses for it. This is our form of entertainment. When we got a night off, this is what we do. Anyway, David Naughton is one of these guys. He was in one of these sitcoms, as I recall, and he's kind of the king of the failed sitcom. He was like the star of a lot of failed sitcoms, just one after another. Also star of one of my favorite movies, American Werewolf in London. And he was almost just as famous for his Dr. Pepper commercial where he dances in the street and sings, "I'm a pepper, you're a pepper," blah, blah. I can't remember it all. But anyway, that's he's that guy. So, you know, dark hair, really great smile, good-looking dude. And I know way too much about failed sitcom actors. Anyway, so he was probably in I don't know, the 70s and 80s, just countless projects that did not pan out. His agent just kept throwing him stuff, you know. So I kept thinking of something in relation to all this. This happened to me years ago, and I was at our merch table one night after a show, and I saw this man. He was like standing there, hands in his pockets, very pensive, and studying the merch table, all the stuff on it, my entire line of CDs, T-shirts, posters, books. He said he was amazed at my output, all this stuff on the table from an artist he'd never heard of before that night. I think he came with a friend, and, you know, the friend just said, "Oh, you'll have a good time, just come along with me." And he ended up buying stuff and all that. So anyway, before he left, he said, "Man, let me just tell you, if you never get famous, it won't be for lack of trying." Like, I looked down at the merch table and I saw things from his perspective and I got it, you know. It was a lot of stuff. And I have more stuff on the table now and I'm no more famous. So, you know, I've added a podcast now to my workload. So, you know, what does this say about me? I don't know. Anyway, so he left and we laughed about it, you know, and everything. But I thought about that for a long time. Like, yeah, won't be for lack of trying. I mean, and I think of all these actors that we see in these failed sitcoms and movies that just, you know, came and went and no real tangible mark left from all of their hard work, you know, at least seemingly. And it got me to thinking. There are a lot of reasons why obscurity lingers for some, you know, despite every effort to get their work out there. But we have to consider this. Maybe they were just content. You know, I've met so many gifted people who never wanted the limelight, you know, saying that that was a price too high to pay for what would have made up their dreams. I think it was Jim Carrey who said, "I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that it's not the answer." Yeah, man. These days, I would say that my ambition has found a worthy opponent in my contentedness. I am happy where I am and with what I've accomplished. I hope to accomplish more, of course, but the price tag will have to be equal to or worthy of the reward. And in the meantime, while enlightenment tries to find me, I'll be here doing what I do and trying to stay out of my own way. Henry David Thoreau told us that not until we are lost do we begin to understand ourselves. Being lost isn't a bad thing, at least not for a while. We've all been there, and if you're anything like me, Thoreau's words should probably give you a lot of hope. That's it for this episode. Thanks, cousins. I've got a bunch of new tour dates at my website at unhitched.com. Over the next 6 months, I'm going to be in Michigan, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Tennessee, California, Nevada, and Washington. So yes, lest you start to think I'm going to get too comfortable and content, I will keep the tour dates coming. We're working on a Nashville field trip for January 2019 and a Key West field trip in February 2019 on Valentine's weekend. Stay tuned at unhitched.com for details as they happen. Now, the best way to stay in touch with us, with me, is to join the newsletter right there at unhitched.com, right on the homepage, and I'll send you monthly news on what's going on here in Pineview Heights. Our 10th anniversary of Woodflock is coming up in May on Memorial Day weekend in Red Bluff, California, 2019. The micro festival we produce every year, and this time we're jam-packing the weekend full of music. We've always had, you know, one or two acts join us, for the weekend. This time, we're going to have a lot more than that. I already have confirmation from our beloved Michael McNevin and bass player Pat McClellan, who will join us. They both said they wouldn't miss it. Woodflock favorite Steve Spurgeon will be there. Sourdough Slim will be returning, along with his able sideman, multi-instrumentalist Robert Armstrong. I love that guy, one of my favorite people on the planet. Of course, I will be performing along with the amazing Trailer Park Troubadours, whoever I can round up with me, along those lines. I've got some surprises I can't really say just yet, but we got some special music joining us as well. I will keep you posted. Anyway, it's a great time, and this year will be very special. And for a limited time, you can save $50 a person when signing up with our Early Bird Special. As always, keep up with my creative output at unhitched.com, where you can buy my posters, prints, books, CDs, and DVDs all right there at the click of a button. I'll make sure each item is signed and sealed with a cousinly hug from me to you. Thanks for being there, cousins. I'm Ancy McLean. Take care of each other. Use your powers for good. And we'll see you next time on Resisting Enlightenment. Have a nice rest of your day.